thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. So today I'll be telling you about some new work with Herman Verlinde, and I'll also refer to past work with Sylvia Pufu, Herman Verlinde, and Yifan Wang, who's here. So I'll be talking about how to move the Swartzian deep into the bulk. Before I start, I want to say that it's been wonderful to be at this conference that had so many Bootstrap talks, but I thought it would be nice to have some diversity. So this talk will not be directly Bootstrap related, but it will make contact with a lot of ideas about conformal field theory, the conformal group in one dimension, and ABS-CFT. Before I actually start giving the talk, I want to give you some setup and motivation. Today I'll be discussing JT gravity, which is a gravitational theory in two dimensions, whose dynamical degrees of freedom are dilaton and the metric. The dilaton couples to the metric in the following way. And if we impose Dirichlet boundary conditions, namely we fix the metric along the boundary to be some constant, we fix the overall length, and we also fix the value of the dilaton phi on the boundary to be some phi b over epsilon. Right now, just treat epsilon as some parameter. I'll describe the meaning in 1 second. So if we have Dirichlet boundary conditions, in order to have a well-defined variational problem, we also need to add a boundary term to our gravitational action. So this integral is over the entire manifold, and this integral is only over the boundary. And in principle, we could add several counter terms to the action that I'll discuss throughout the talk. So why should we study this? Why should we care? The reason why I think it's interesting to study this is because, as far as we know so far, this is a solvable model of quantum gravity in the epsilon going to zero limit. So here, what I mean is that GUU would be very large, and the value of the dilaton would also be very large. And the meaning of that is that the space that we are describing will end up being the whole of something very close to being the whole of ADS2. So we know how to solve it for disk topologies, and the system, as I will show very shortly, will turn out to be equivalent to the Swartzian theory. And we also know how to solve this for any topology. And in gravitational theories, we would want to sum over topologies, and this system turns out to be equivalent to a matrix model. Another exciting reason to study this is because the theory serves as a good toy model of holography. Namely, we could consider an arbitrary number of operators in the bulk, compute their expectation value, and prove that they match operators on the boundary. So the example that I will discuss today will only focus on the partition function. However, in this work that I've done with Sylvie, Herman, and Yifan, we focused on various observables that have very interesting interpretations in terms of SL2R. As I was saying before, the theory so far has been solved in the epsilon going to zero limit. But it will be very interesting to try to understand what happens if we go away from that limit. Namely, why do we have to only restrict to manifolds that have an asymptotically ADS2 boundary? So the general goal that I would like to propose is solve the theory with general boundary conditions. However, that turns out to be a little bit too hard. And today, I'll focus on finding the partition function of JT gravity to all orders in perturbation theory in this parameter epsilon. So remember, when epsilon is small, the manifold is asymptotically ADS2. When epsilon is large, the manifold that we'll describe will be smaller and smaller with respect to ADS2 radii. So why study this? Whenever we move the boundary into the bulk, we could access more and more properties that the bulk has. So this comes back to ideas in bulk reconstruction and holographic RG. And I just want to pinpoint an idea that an example that will end up being important later in the talk that happens in ADS-free CFT2. where there was a proposal a couple of years ago by McAuliffe, Metze, and Verlinde that a two-dimensional CFT deformed by the TT bar deformation is dual to bulk, an ADS-free bulk, with a boundary placed at finite cutoff. So stay tuned, have this idea in mind, and we'll come back to it at the end of the talk. So funny enough, I'm actually not the first person to give a talk at the Bootstrap conference on this exact same topic. If you guys were here last year, well, at Caltech last year, there was a talk by Kitaev in which he also showed some way to address this problem at finite cutoff. But as we will see at the end of the talk, our results end up to be completely different, and I'll explain why. Good. So because I think that we probably have different people knowing different things, I'll first review how to solve JT gravity on the disk topology in the epsilon going to zero limit. So when the boundary is asymptotically ADS2. The JT gravity path integral is given by taking this action and integrating against the metric and the dilaton. And the important point that simplifies the entire calculation is that the dilaton serves as a Lagrange multiplier. So namely, in order for this path integral to be convergent in Euclidean signature, we have to choose the contour for the dilaton to be given by some constant that will take to be the boundary value of the dilaton plus some imaginary part. So in this case, it's very easy to see that this variable phi serves as a Lagrange multiplier that imposes that the curvature plus 2 needs to be 0. So essentially, this tells you that all the manifolds that we're integrating over in this path integral are have constant negative curvature. So they're just patches of ADS2. So the remaining degrees of freedom that we have are essentially the boundary degrees of freedom, because we are left with an integral over the extrinsic curvature. Good. So I'll choose the following parametrization for the ADS2 metric. This is in Euclidean signature, and this is in Lorentzian signature. The reason I point out the parametrization in Lorentzian signature will come about later, so for now, I'll just focus on the Euclidean parametrization. So we're only doing a Euclidean path integral. So we have this path integral, but we also want to impose the boundary conditions, the Dirichlet boundary conditions that I specified earlier. We fix the metric along the boundary to be 1 over epsilon squared. So we have some equation in terms of the variables tau and x, which are parametrized by some arbitrary parametrization u of the boundary that has total length beta. And we could solve this equation explicitly to first order in epsilon. And I have to mention, this is what Maldacena, Stanford, and Yang did in order to recover the equivalence between JT gravity and the Schwarzian action. So the solution here is pretty clear. It's just that x is proportional to the derivative of t times epsilon, and then there's corrections of order epsilon squared. So what I'll be talking today is what to do about all these corrections on the right. Now we could take this value and plug it into the extrinsic curvature. So the extrinsic curvature is a function that's in terms of tau and x. And when we plug into this function, we find that the after expanding in a series in epsilon, I get that k is 1 plus epsilon squared times the Schwarzian action plus some order 4 correction, where the Schwarzian is given by the following pretty ugly function, triple derivative divided by a single derivative minus 3 halves. You guys could read it. So any questions so far? Yes. In fact, like most of my talk we'll kind of go around that. So maybe I'll just give you a little bit of a preamble. Why it has to appear is because we want our boundary to obey the same isometry as ADS2 space. So ADS2 has an SL2R isometry. And we could explicitly check that with the appropriate transformation on tau and x, this boundary condition remains invariant under the isometry, but also the extrinsic curvature by definition is also invariant under the isometry. So at the end of the day, if I solve for tau as a function of x and plug it in here, I should get something that is SL2R invariant. And it turns out that the unique SL2R invariant function that contains this number of derivatives ends up being the Schwarzian action. So I will talk about that in way more detail a little bit later in the talk. Very well. Good. So one thing that I want to mention that's interesting and that gets people excited is that the Schwarzian action can also be recovered from different quantum mechanical models in the low energy limits, such as SYK. That's why people think that those quantum mechanical models have a nice holographic dual. So now the problem has been heavily simplified. Instead of solving a two-dimensional path integral, we now have to solve the path integral for a one-dimensional system, namely ZJT. Is now d mu tau e to the phi b for epsilon squared integral du 1 plus epsilon squared. And I'll take some of a counter term, a possible counter term in the JT path integral to cancel this 1 here. So this one only contributes a constant to the path integral, so I could just eliminate it. Okay. Good. So that's what I was going to discuss next. So what is this measure? So in principle, this measure, there are several ways of obtaining this measure. The nicest, one of the cleanest ways to obtain it is by reformulating JT gravity as a BF theory whose gauge algebra is SL2R. And Witten, in the early 90s, wrote a formula for the symplectic form in this SL2R in a general BF theory. And one could use that symplectic measure to actually derive the measure on the boundary. But a simpler way to think about it is the following. So here, we chose some arbitrary parametrization of the boundary. This is what this U is. So in principle, we could have chosen a different function. Like suppose that instead of tau of U, we choose tau of F of U. And in principle, there's no reason why this measure should depend on this change of parametrization. So then the conclusion would be that this measure needs to be reparametrization invariant. The only reparametrization invariant measure that one could write down that's local is a product over U at all places around the circle times d tau of U divided by tau prime of U. So here you could check explicitly that if I compose the, if I write U as f of U, then this function remains invariant under that reparametrization. One thing that I have to specify is that here the variable tau goes from minus infinity to infinity and is also monotonic. That happens for asymptotically ADS2 boundaries. So tau prime is greater than 0. But on the other hand, we want to impose that tau goes back to itself along the boundary because we're on a Euclidean boundary. So if tau of 0 is equal to tau of beta, so the only way to satisfy these two conditions at the same time is to have a point at which there is a singularity. So what it turns out is that tau of u can be written as the tan of pi eta of u over beta, where eta of u is a diff S1 function. So for instance, if I take any monotonic function that's in diff S1, so eta of beta minus eta of 0 is beta, and take the tan of it, it will still remain monotonic with the exception of a singular point where it's singular and it's periodic. And one thing that I want to mention is that, of course, in order to satisfy these boundary conditions, there are multiple options that differ by an integer choice in the tan. But for now, I'll focus on the lowest winding mode. So now we almost have the exact definition of the space that we need to integrate over. There's one final detail, namely, yes. Yeah. Just we can put this as negative beta over 2 to beta over 2. Sorry. Minus infinity. It's fine. Like in principle, I'll explain why a singular point is fine from the act, from the perspective of the action. Usually, singular points are not fine to have in my path integral because the action is divergent, and such configurations will be disallowed. But it turns out that if you plug in the Schwarzian action for the tangent of a monotonic function, then you'll get that the action is finite everywhere. And that's a nice property that comes from the fact that we're actually dividing derivatives. While usually in typical actions, we just have a kinetic term. So when we have a discontinuity in our function, we just get a divergence in the action, which is bad. Yeah, you could get it from here. So we're restricting to the domain where x is greater than 0. So here, from this relation, you could explicitly get that if epsilon is greater than 0, then tau dot is greater than 0. Good. So there's one more detail about the integration space that I want to mention, which is that, as I mentioned before, to Slava, ADS2 has an SL2R isometry, and I don't want to integrate over configurations that are related by SL2R isometries, because that's a zero mode of the action, almost by definition. So then, I'll quotient my space by SL2R transformations, and I'll mention what those SL2R transformations are in a moment. So my integration space is with eta being in diff S1 over SL2R. So before I go on to solve that path integral or to review the solution of that path integral, I just want to mention the classical solutions and the classical properties of the theory. So to start, I want to mention the SL2R isometry, how it manifests itself in the tau variable. Namely, you can see that the tau variable has the symmetry tau goes to a tau plus b over c tau plus d. And this is actually, The fact that the Schwarzian is invariant under these reparametrizations is why mathematicians are actually interested in the Schwarzian to begin with. Good. This symmetry has free currents that generate an SL2R algebra. And the curious fact about this theory is that the Schwarzian is not only the Lagrangian of the theory. If you if you go to the Hamiltonian formulation, it ends up that the Schwarzian is also the Hamiltonian. So this is something that you could just do classically, and the Hamiltonian also ends up being the Casimir of this SL2R symmetry. So we'll see what the interpretation of that is in the path integral formulation of the theory in 1 second. Okay, so now it's very easy to derive the equations of motion because we know that the theory is conservative. There's nothing that explicitly depends on time in the Lagrangian. So then the equation of motion just comes from the conservation equation of the Hamiltonian, namely that the derivative of the Schwarzian is zero. And I'd like to mention the solution. So the reason why I go for the classical analysis is not because I actually care about the classical behavior of the system, but as you will see very shortly, this classical solution will actually play a very important role in my derivation at finite cutoff. So the classical solution is tau of u equal tan of au. And if I plug this back into the action, I get that the Schwarzian in this configuration is just equal to 2a squared. And the boundary condition that require periodicity tell me that a needs to be pi over beta. Good. Any questions about the classical analysis or the symmetries of the problem? Great. So now I'll briefly talk about how other people solved this path integral. This path integral was first solved exactly by Stanford and Witten using fermionic localization. So in order to perform yes? Yes. Sorry?
Let me throw that up.
Nice. Thank you, nice catch. Are there an infinite number of conserved charges of the Schwarzian quantum mechanics theory that are like the analog of the ADB charges? Because presumably the fact that it's exactly solvable means that it's integrable, and you probably can understand that straight from
yes,
the
probably that's true. I think it's actually very easy to see that any power of the Hamiltonian is also conserved. So you could you could construct arbitrary SL2R Casimirs that are also conserved. So in principle, the SL2R Casimir, there's a unique quadratic SL2R Casimir, but you could take powers of that to construct higher order Casimirs. But there's no other independent Casimir in here.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not sure if those correspond to the KdV charges that you were mentioning.
I think the KdV charges might do something different.
We could talk more after the talk. This path integral was first solved by Stanford and Witten using fermionic localization. And in order to do that, they used two properties. The first is that the integral that we're doing in the path integral is a symplectic manifold. And that just comes from the fact that diff S1 over SL2R is symplectic. And the second is that they proved that the Schwarzian is a U1 generator that corresponds to time translations on the symplectic manifold. So I won't go into details. I'll just state the result, because that's what I'll be using. Namely, they found that the partition function of JT gravity can be written as the following integral. So it's pretty much a Gaussian integral. Good. And it could be exactly written in terms of phi b m beta. Okay, so I just want to briefly give you an interpretation, since this theory has an SL to R global symmetry. I just want to briefly, very briefly, give you an interpretation of where SL to R comes into this partition function. And I'll come back later in discussing a generalized version of what I'm saying now. So this can be identified actually as a Poincaré measure for the universal cover of SL to R. For representations in the principal series with a fixed charge under a Z-center symmetry. And this could be identified as the Casimir of SL to R that's shifted by a quarter. So usually for the principal series, the Casimir of SL to R is S squared minus a quarter, plus a quarter. So here, I'm just writing a shifted version of that. I could just shift my Hamiltonian by a constant, essentially. Very well. So now we, this is the end of my review of solving JT gravity with asymptotically ADS2 boundary conditions. So I want to tell you first why it's hard to solve the problem at finite cutoff. So if we review what we did in order to get this action, we started from by solving the constraint imposed by boundary conditions. Namely, we said that 1 over epsilon squared was tau prime squared plus x prime squared divided by x squared. And if you solve for that in the next order in perturbation theory, what you find is that x of u is epsilon t prime plus epsilon cubed t double prime squared divided by t2 prime. So if you plug into k once again, you once again recover the Schwarzian at order epsilon squared. But at order epsilon to the 4, you recover a very, very ugly function that includes all sorts of derivatives. So for instance, there's a term that looks like t double prime, the fourth derivative of t divided by t prime squared, plus other terms. So you know, as I go to higher and higher order in epsilon, I have to include more and more derivatives in tau. And the system becomes harder and harder to deal with. So what we're interested in is an organizing principle that could help us understand what k is to all orders in perturbation theory in epsilon. So we could go one step back and ask, what was the problem here? So if you look at this action, you'll notice that what happened is that tau goes to a tau plus b over c tau plus d is no longer a symmetry. But the problem is that ADS2 at finite cutoff still has an SL to R isometry. So why would it be that there is no longer an SL to R symmetry? So the answer is that, in fact, there is. But the problem is that it's not very apparent in these variables tau and x. So that's why I'll have to introduce a new set of coordinates. So this brings me to point two. So I'll introduce the set of light core coordinates z equal x plus I tau, and z bar equals x minus I tau. And the motivation is the following. So we can actually check that the isometry in ADS2 that I was mentioning earlier is actually x plus I tau goes to ax plus I tau plus b divided by cx plus I tau plus d. So now you could actually identify what happened, why this is no longer a symmetry. What happened is that I was interested in the tau variable. And to first order in perturbation theory, x was epsilon tau prime. So here, to first order, tau goes to a tau plus b over c tau plus d was actually a symmetry. But if I want to include the next order in perturbation theory, this symmetry transformation will involve derivatives of tau. So it will be very ugly. But in the ZZ bar coordinates, the transformation is simple. Namely, the important thing is that when I transform Z or transform Z bar, each transformation is independent of the other variable. While here, you can see that the transformation in X depends on the value of tau. So if I try to solve for X as a function of tau, I'll clearly get something quite unfortunate. So then let me outline the strategy. We have the new metric in these light cone coordinates. And the boundary condition now becomes 1 over epsilon squared is 4 z dot z bar dot over z plus z bar squared. Suppose that I managed to solve this equation. So solve for z bar as a function of z of u. And I plug it into k of z and z bar. K of z and z bar is an ugly function that I will not write unless someone explicitly asks me to. If I plug z bar here, I'll just get k as a function of z of u. And the nice property of this function is that because z has this SL2R transformation and z bar has this SL2R transformation, it implies that k of z of u is also SL2R invariant under this specific transformation of z. So it does not involve any derivatives in terms of z bar or z. OK, so in these coordinates, I recovered an action that actually has an SL2R symmetry that acts locally in the field Z. So why is that important? Why could I actually use that? The reason why it's important is because we could make the following observation. So K could be written as in a perturbative expansion in epsilon. Previously, I only wrote the epsilon squared term. So now, I could write it as epsilon to the n, kn, and it depends on z of u. And derivatives of z of u that end up being up to order n plus 1. So let's try to constrain what this function could be. So first, I want to just take the free generators of SL2R transformations and constrain this function. So let's take first the transformation z goes to z plus b. This implies that kn is independent of z. And only depends on derivatives of z. If I take z goes to az, this implies that kn only depends on ratios. Zn divided by zm. If I take z goes to 1 over z, what I have to do is take some of these ratios and see what terms I have to add such that it becomes SL2R invariant. And the terms that end up being necessary make it such that kn only depends on the Schwarzian and derivatives of the Schwarzian. So I want to give you some intuition that goes back to the classical analysis. So previously in the classical analysis, remember that I told you that the Hamiltonian is the same as the Schwarzian and is the same as the SL2R Casimir. And I know that SL2R has a unique quadratic Casimir, and all higher powers of the Casimir could be written only in terms of the quadratic Casimir. So this is pretty much a statement of that, because we know that in order for Kn to be invariant under SL2R transformations, I need to write it as a function of Casimirs. So the only way to write it as a function of Casimirs is to write it in terms of Casimirs to some powers and derivatives of Casimirs. So then this conclusion follows. So now I've more heavily constrained these functions Kn that appear in the perturbative series of K. So I know this general fact, but I still don't know what K is. So how do I actually determine K? So to determine K, we could actually take the classical solution that we discussed previously, in which the Schwarzian was a constant. So previously, we studied a classical solution for the problem that for the problem in first-order perturbation theory, for which z of u was tan au. And the Schwarzian in this configuration turned out to be 2a squared. So even though K has a way more complicated equation of motion and does not have this classical solution, I'm still allowed to plug this classical solution into the function K and see what I get. And from there, knowing that Kn is only a function of the Schwarzian and derivatives of the Schwarzian, I could actually just read off the contribution of the Schwarzian to each function Kn. So the way to do this is using this solution. We could now solve for the boundary conditions once again. So I try to solve for z bar once again. And I get the z bar. I have to solve the following differential equation. Where A is this arbitrary parameter in my tan solution. So luckily, this differential equation ends up being exactly solvable, even though it's not linear. It's not a linear differential equation. There's some really ugly solution for z bar that you could get in Mathematica if you really wanted to, that you could just plug in K. So now we could solve for K of z equal tan of AU, and z bar equal corresponding solution. And what we find is that this is equal to the square root of 1 plus 4a squared epsilon squared tan of u over 2 epsilon square root of 1 plus 4a squared epsilon squared. So this tells me two things. One is that if I expand k to all orders in perturbation theory, u does not contribute. So all orders in perturbation theory of k are independent of u. U only appears through non-perturbative contributions. So this is exactly what I expect, because if what I said was true, that Kn depends only on the Schwarzians and derivatives of the Schwarzian, then if I had some u dependence in some power of in some term that appears with a power of epsilon, then that could not be true, because in this solution, we know that the Schwarzian is a constant. So from here, I could get the contribution of the Schwarzians to K. So namely, K can be written as square root of 1 plus 2 epsilon squared Schwarzian of Z and U plus non-perturbative corrections. Plus derivative terms in this Wartian. Okay, so this is pretty big progress from a function that looked very ugly and had arbitrary many derivatives. I at least know how to get some part of it. I still have arbitrarily many derivatives because of the derivatives in the Wartian, but as it will turn out, they will actually drop out from the contribution that they have in the path integral. So now my goal is to solve the JT partition function with this k. So d mu z e to the phi b over epsilon squared 0 beta du. And I'll subtract a 1 because I want to get the same answer to first order and perturbation theory as I got with the Wartian. So if I'd expand the square root in an epsilon expansion, the first term is 1, the same as what you got for k to begin with, but you just subtract it using a counter term in the JT gravity path integral. So the path integral is this plus derivative terms. And as I said at the beginning of the talk, for now, I don't know how to resolve the non-perturbative corrections to this action, but I will have some comments about their importance at the end of the talk. Okay, which brings me to point 4. The new path integral and the exact quantization. Before I start actually going into how to solve this path integral, I want to once again say what this function d mu of z is, what this measure is. Because as far as we know, it might be different. So, good. First of all, notice that we've integrated out z bar. And we're only left with an integral in terms of z. So I'll have the freedom to analytically continue my function on my contour for the z-path integral from the Euclidean contour for which z is equal to z bar star. To the Lorentzian contour for which z is real. Good. Now let's see what the boundary conditions imply in Lorentzian signature. So the boundary conditions say that for z dot z bar dot over z plus z bar squared is 1 over epsilon squared. And if I want my boundary to be an analytic continuation of the geometric Euclidean boundary, so the one that makes sense geometrically, then we can see that 1 over epsilon squared needs to be positive, which means that the boundary is time-like. So we can clearly see here that, you know, these both functions are real, so the square is real. So it implies that z bar is greater than 0 and, z dot is greater than 0 and z bar dot is greater than 0, or z bar is smaller than 0 and z bar dot is smaller than 0. However, these two transformations are related by an SL2R transformation. So for now, I'll just focus on, it's equivalent to focus on either of them. So I'll just talk about this one. So we have, once again, our contour is only involves integrating over a space of monotonic functions. However, once again, in the parametrization in Euclidean signature, we have that the function z of 0 is equal to z of beta. So the conclusion, once again, is that z of u is the tan of a diff S1 function. right? Once again, my choice of parametrization is arbitrary. So the measure still needs to be reparameterization invariant. So the measure in Z, or in eta variables, is still a product of U over the entire thermal interval, dz over z bar. Good. So the idea is the following. I now have my path integral. And in these z coordinates, when I analytically continue them to z being real, I have exactly the same integration space and the same integration measure as I initially had in my Schwarzian theory. So this path integral is the same as the Schwarzian path integral up to higher corrections in the Schwarzian. So the idea now is, instead of quantizing this theory by itself, which is kind of complicated, and I'm actually not sure if one could do fermionic localization in this theory, because as we will see at the end of the day, the path integral ends up being not one loop exact. Instead of doing this path integral by itself, I could treat this as a deformation of the Schwarzian theory. So I'll compute the expectation value of the operator e to the integral of 0 to beta, sum from n equal 2 to infinity. So the n equal 1 term is the Schwarzian action itself. Phi b alpha n epsilon to the 2n minus 2. Schwarzian to the power n of u plus derivative terms, where these coefficients, alpha n, are just the coefficients that appear in the epsilon expansion of the square root function. So now, the idea is that I know how to do this problem if I know how to compute the correlation function of an arbitrary number of Schwarzian operators in the Schwarzian theory. By the way, since I'm using the shorthand notation where I'm dropping the variable z. So it turns out that one could actually solve this using a very beautiful trick first suggested by Witten and Stanford. Namely, I could use the following property of the Schwarzian. So, before I do that, I want to say that already we have some intuition that the Schwarzian is equal to the is proportional to the Hamiltonian. So I could actually get what this function is, to some degree. It's just the integral over ds times s times inch of 2 pi s. And the only thing I have to do is plug in powers of the Hamiltonian, which is the same thing as plugging values of the SL2R Casimir, which I'll just take to be s squared. So it's plugging powers of s squared like this. Oh, this is beta. So you get an answer. But the problem is that this correlation function does not include contact terms. And contact terms end up being very important if we want to expand this exponential, because it also the exponential also has integrals. So if I have contact terms here, then they will actually contribute to the expectation value of these operators. So I don't know if I have time to review the method to derive the contact terms. Should I just go over the result, or? OK, perfect. Yeah, it's enough. Good. So the way to derive these contact terms is using this beautiful trick. in which one could rewrite the Schwarzian of a function of y and x in terms of x. So here I'm just going to write the what happens if instead of putting a function of x, I put a function of y of x. So I'm writing the composition rule for the Schwarzian derivative. So this ends up being the Schwarzian of f of y, derivative of x with respect to y, squared plus the Schwarzian of y and x. Good. So now I'm going to consider x being equal to some h, where h is a diffeos 1 function. So it's some arbitrary function. And y being equal to my old u. So h is an arbitrary reparametrization of the circle. So now, the idea is the following. I want to plug this into the path integral that I have for a single Schwarzian, this relation. So I get that integral over d mu eta, e to the phi b integral over dh, Schwarzian of pi eta of u of h divided by beta with respect to h. So notice that now I'm actually changing the time from u to h. This is equal by this relation to the integral over d mu eta e to the phi b. Integral over dh, dh with respect to u squared, Schwarzian of tan of pi eta over beta with respect to u, plus Schwarzian of h of u. And this, so first of all, this, notice that it's the same thing as the partition function, with the only replacement that instead of writing u, I wrote h. So this is the same as the Schwarzian path integral. Now, on the right-hand side, what I find is that this function can be rewritten as the path integral of d mu of eta. And now I'm going to change my time back to u. So I'm going to do a transformation in which I write this integral over dh as an integral over du times the derivative. So if I do that, I end up with the following. And I'm going to do a second trick where I can exchange u and h in the Schwarzian at the cost of some extra derivatives. So this is just a mathematical relation that you guys can check. OK, so this seems kind of abstract, but what I've done is that I managed to rewrite the Schwarzian path integral in terms of where on the right-hand side, I have an arbitrary diffeos 1 function, h, which means that I could treat this arbitrary diffeos 1 function as a source. So I could now take on the right-hand side derivatives, functional derivatives with respect to h. And this is what ends up giving me contact terms in the two-point function, three-point function, so on. So let me tell you the overall idea. So the overall idea is that the Schwarzian endpoint function within the Schwarzian theory can can always be written as I'll denote this by the expectation value of this thing within this distribution. So expectation value of s to the 2n plus a sum over delta functions times the distribution that's one power lower, plus a sum over product of delta or over all combinations of delta functions times the expectation value of s to a power that's once again lower, all the way down to having the product over all delta functions times the expectation value of s squared. Plus higher derivative terms in delta of xij. Okay, so let's extract some conclusions now from that nasty formula. So the first conclusion is that in order to actually compute the path integral that I wanted to compute in the beginning that had powers of the Schwarzians, I have some of these contact terms become delta of 0, and they need to be subtracted by separating the points in the operator at which the operator is inserted a little bit. The second point is that if I take derivatives of the Schwarzian anywhere here, I will only get contributions that come from derivatives of delta functions. And if I integrate derivatives of delta functions n times, so here I'll end up with the Schwarzian integrated n times, I'll always get 0. So then if I put any derivative of the Schwarzian over here, it will end up not having a contribution to the expectation value. Which makes sense because, as I was telling you before, the Schwarzian is the Hamiltonian, and d mu h equals 0 is, you know, an operator equation that we expect to be true in general. Now, the third conclusion is that we can actually resum the terms that appear there back into an exponential. And what we get is that the JT partition function can be written as integral of ds times s times sinh of 2 pi s e to the minus beta by n divided by 2, sum n equal 1 to infinity, minus 2 to the n minus 1. Let me erase so that I can write in a single line. Great. Alpha n, s to the 2n, phi b, the 2n e epsilon to the 2n, plus non-perturbative corrections that I don't know how to account for, where alpha n are the coefficients in the square root expansion that I mentioned previously. So this thing ends up summing to ds times s times sinh of 2 pi s e to the minus beta phi n over 2 square root of 1 minus, sorry, 1 minus square root of 1 minus 4 epsilon squared s squared divided by phi b squared. Okay, so now we can rewrite this in terms of a density of states, d e rho of e, e to the minus beta e, by just taking this to be the energy and deriving what the density of states is here by solving for s as a function of v. And if you do that, you get that rho of v is a function is like this, 1 over square root of phi b, 1 minus 4 epsilon squared e over phi b, sinh of 2 pi square root d phi b. Okay. So one observation about this function is that this density of states actually has a maximum, after which it drops down, goes through zero, and afterwards we don't really know what's happening. The reason why we don't know what's happening is because how we derive this formula is in an epsilon expansion, and this epsilon expansion, as you very well see, because I wrote the closed form expression that corresponds to this expansion, has a branch cut. And the branch cut starts whenever the thing under the square root is smaller than zero. So what we can guarantee is that this works up to that value. And in principle, what we expect to happen is that there are non-protrubative corrections that might impose a cutoff over the S integral that would correspond to this value. So now, this is the final result. This is the partition function of JT gravity at finite cutoff. And I just want to very, very, very quickly mention, in the last 7 minutes, two things. So as I was kind of advertising at the beginning of the talk, all this has something to do with TT bar. Now I want to discuss a recent paper by Gross, Krutoff, Rolf, and Shagulian. Edgar was here last week, which one of their chapters and one of their sections in the paper, they essentially perform a dimensional reduction of the TT bar result and claim that that corresponds to a sort of analogous deformation of the quantum mechanical system. So we'll consider a CFT whose Euclidean partition function is deformed by TT bar. And as you all well know, such a deformation implies that the energy levels of the 2D conformal field theory satisfy a differential equation. That can be written in terms of the, so here I put my CFT on S1 times R. And these are the energy levels, and J is the angular momentum around S1. And one can prove that the energy levels satisfy the following differential equation, which have the solution that E, as a function of the deformation, can be written in terms of my initial energy and the angular momentum. So if I want to dimensionally reduce this theory, I want to look at the J equals zero sector. And in the J equals zero sector, what's happening is that I'm dropping this term. So I'm simply getting that E of lambda is 1 over 4 lambda, 1 minus square root of 1 minus 8 lambda E0. So now let's consider the one-dimensional system that results from this dimensional reduction to actually be given by the Schwarzian theory. I don't know how realistic that is for an actual dimensional reduction of two-dimensional CFT. But the idea is that if I take the energy level here to be given by that in the Schwarzian, so the energy levels, remember, were just proportional to S squared. And if I relate my parameter lambda to my cutoff epsilon as lambda equals epsilon squared over phi beta, what I get is that E as a function of epsilon squared is actually phi b over 4 epsilon squared, 1 minus square root of 1 minus 4 epsilon squared s squared divided by phi b squared. But what I get is exactly the result that I get for the energy in the partition function of JT gravity, where I want to pause and note that the JT gravity derivation, in principle, has nothing to do with the TT bar deformation. It's just a calculation by itself, where I'm doing like exactly a path integral in a 1D system that's been reduced from gravity. I just wanted to review a couple of the tricks that I've used in order to derive this result. So the first thing that was important was to actually observe that the calculations greatly simplify in light cone coordinates. The second thing that was important is to realize that all terms in the perturbative expansion of the extrinsic curvature can be written in terms of the Schwarzian. The third trick that was important was that by using the classical solution to my old problem, to my initial problem that only had the Schwarzian as the action, I was actually able to derive all Schwarzian terms present in the extrinsic curvature. And finally, the fourth trick was to generalize the calculation of Stanford and Witten to be able to derive the correlation function of an arbitrary number of Schwarzian operators, resum that, and get this final partition function. Just one last comment, which is that at the beginning of the talk, I said that Kitaev also gave this talk the previous year in the Bootstrap. The difference there is that his integration space it actually allows for intersecting configurations of intersecting boundaries in Lorentzian signature. And if you remember, the boundary condition that I imposed, well, that is imposed usually in gravity, the Dirichlet boundary condition, actually disallows for intersecting configurations and tells you that you're only supposed to integrate over boundaries that are time-like. And the difference between the two calculations is that I'm integrating over configurations that are, that obey this boundary condition while he isn't. So I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Yes.
Would you write just next to the square root with the under brace the original Hamiltonian that you had? There was a square root of 1 plus epsilon squared times the Schwarzian.
Yes.
Could you write that? I don't think.
The initial action?
Yeah, with the epsilon.
Yeah, so the initial action was square root of 1 plus epsilon squared times Schwarzian of z and u.
I'm trying to see if by doing this expansion and resummation, this factor of 4 and so on, was it? Could I just have naively gotten that answer by plugging in?
What happens here due to the contact terms is a change of sign, actually, which I'm pretty sure is replaced is the same thing as probably doing a Laplace transform somewhere, but I'm not exactly sure tell you to give you a better intuition.
You're saying the sign changed and the constant factor also changed or not?
No, I don't think the constant factor changed. Let me check. Yeah, I don't think it changed. We could take a look at the end, but the Hamiltonian is not quite the Schwarzian. It's related up to a proportionality factor. So here I plugged in the energy being S squared over 2 phi beta. And I think I'm not exactly sure how to give you a better intuition. Yes, Andy.
In the usual ADS3 CFT2 context,
yes,
there's a debate about the sign for the TT bar deformation. Right?
That's right.
Sign has the interpretation
that's
moving
right
to the bulk. But here in your dictionary between lambda, the TT bar parameter, and the epsilon squared, so here the sign is unambiguous. Is that right?
No. So the sign is chosen by the sign that I chose for epsilon squared.
Right.
So the sign for epsilon squared is dictated in Lorentzian signature by the fact that I'm integrating over time-like boundaries. And those are the only ones that can be analytically continued to geometric configurations in Euclidean signature. Of course, there is a sign for which epsilon squared is smaller than zero, and that corresponds to space-like boundaries.
Does that mean the scissor that you would have?
I don't know.
Thank you.
I didn't go that far. So
the Schwarzian density of states can be derived from the large C limit of the modular kernel for the Virasoro vacuum character, or equivalently from the large C limit of the ZZ wave function in Liouville theory. Is there anything going on like that here for this density of state?
I haven't thought much about that, but maybe if one considers a deformation of that theory to begin with, maybe one can derive this. But the problem there is that the whole point here was not to solve the partition function with this action. I think the whole point of the talk was more to derive this action to begin with. That was the difficult part. I think people knew how to resum the path integral for this action with a general function of the Schwarzian. So I don't know how you would go from the gravitational perspective to the CFT perspective. Because I know in the initial paper, I don't know if that's the initial paper, but I know that at least in the paper by Herman, Joaquin, and Thomas Mertens, they start from the Schwarzian action in order to derive the CFT description. So in principle, you need to start from this action in order to derive what the partition function in the deformed theory is. And to derive this action to begin with is somewhere.
For sure. If you look at the spectral curve associated with the density of state, because it looks like just a single cut. Like, it looks like the spectral curve is a sphere, a single cut with square root branch. So, which is,
I have not looked at it. But yeah, maybe there's, that's definitely something to look at.
You could try and use this to kick off topological recursion, just like. Sorry, you could use this to try and kick off topological recursion, just like in the matrix model formulation of JT gravity with the cutoff at the boundary.
Yes.
But the interesting thing is the spectral curve when epsilon equals zero, which is what they use, is this complicated infinite sheeted thing which generates the volumes of moduli spaces. This is now a single cut. As far as I can tell, it looks like a square, single cut with square root branch point. So the spectral curve is a sphere. But somehow it should have varied within it all of the same moduli space volume.
So let me just make one comment, which is I didn't try to think about the matrix model dual that has this density of states, but I did try to think about solving the problem with arbitrary genus at finite cutoff. The problem there is that the difficulty arises because you usually have this integral over the parameter B that corresponds to that appears in the Weil-Petersen measure that corresponds to the geodesic length.
Don't you still have that? The boundary is still not a hyperbolic geodesic.
Yes, that's still true.
You'll get the, I don't know what they call it, like the half cylinder that glues your boundary to something of length B. And then behind that is the Riemann surface.
That's completely correct. The only worry that you should have, and that's where the difficulty arises, is that I don't think you want your boundary to intersect that geodesic. Yeah. So you want your boundary, for instance, in this trumpet geometry, to always be at the left of your geodesic. And this means that there is that depends on the specific Schwarzian configuration that you're considering.
You're saying that now your boundary has finite length, so the range of B that you integrate over
is
not finite.
Exactly. Oh. And the problem is the range of B isn't even to infinity. The range of B is dependent on the Schwarzian variable. So you can't exchange the integrals to begin with.
That might be a feature instead of a bug.
Yeah, it might be a feature.
Discompute integrals of Because what you're actually interested in is the functional dependence on B. And so if you now have a setup where you can dial the range of integration of B, you should still be able to extract the moduli space.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting problem. Well, I could give you the physical meaning that it has in ADS-free. So in ADS-free, in principle, black holes only exist up to a maximum energy. Because in principle, you don't, suppose that I put the cutoff at a finite distance from the center of ADS, then I don't want my the horizon of the black hole to intersect the boundary. So the meaning of the square root is that at the beginning of the branch cut is actually the point where I should cut off my integral over energies because, ADS-free at a finite cutoff, I only need to integrate over black holes up to a finite energy. I only need to consider a path integral with black hole configurations up to a finite energy. Potentially, maybe there is some. I don't think I can make any further comments that are very relevant.